Welcome to Stories That Matter, the Hawkwood podcast. Today we're joined by Steve Savalee of the band Asian Dub Foundation and the Worldwide Tribes Jazz O'Hara. We'll hear all about the Worldwide Tribe from Jazz, but first of all, we join Steve explaining his recent Brexit number one, Coming Over Here, with comedian Stuart Lee.
For us, it's, I think, probably the most successful, the most interesting sort of journey, artistic journey for ADF and the band, because really the whole band itself is, from its inception, immigration and border issues are at the heart of the group. It's natural artistic territory. Well, here's the thing, guess the irony, a lot of people, when they clicked on Coming Over Here, the ad that came up was Nigel Farage parody, trying to peddle some insurance scheme, which I thought was very ironic. It's a very unusual combination, and I think Stuart Lee himself talked about, well, it's quite unusual to have a record that's kind of funny and comical, but also has something to say, and it's quite, I don't know, aggressive isn't the word, but slightly confrontational and forthright about its message. It's, anti-UKIP, anti-xenophobic message. So it was all very cool how it all turned out. And the track goes on, and we're still raising money for Kent Refugee Action Network and all the great work that Bridget and co do down there. This kind of consciousness that the band has, it's almost instinctive and natural. It goes back to the inception of the group, and immigration and border issues were there right at the start, because Asian Dub Foundation was originally a music education project. And it was formed to try and get young Asians involved in music in order to get them interested in some of the anti-fascist action that was going on in the early 90s in Britain, particularly due to the rise of the BNP in the East End of London. And that was the, in fact, Asian Dub Foundation's first gig as a sound system was a anti-BNP benefit. And the original band was two much older members and a very young rapper, Dida, who was like 15. And so the band itself was quite unusual, because we were all like youth workers, music tutors, and then we would work and still do work with much younger people. So the age range was like 15 to early 30s, which was, and we were all from very diverse backgrounds, despite the Asian sort of tag. And so the interesting thing about the band, and makes it quite, there are precedents actually, but we had this sort of parallel rise, a more conventional rise in like getting known by the music press, doing some very big support slots, people like Radiohead and Rage Against the Machine and what have you, touring America, Mercury Music Prize nomination, all that. But at the same time, it also built a music education profile. And I am a music, I'm a workshop tutor by trade. And two other people in the band were too. And what we were able to do through the success of the group, we were able to make links and in very interesting ways. And we were able to get sort of like profile for the whole idea of music education. I'll give you an example. One of the first things I did with the band, we took the band to Budapest, and we were involved in a project called Roma Dub Migration. And this was to do with the Roma people in Budapest, who, well, as I'm sure you know, the sad thing is, I'm talking about, you know, this was a very successful project. This is in the late 90s. And, it was very positive. It was a really good vibe. We got people who were treated very, very badly in Hungary, the Roma people. And we played on stage with them. And the contact between Roma and the Hungarian majority then was very scant, and there was all kinds of stereotypes, racist stereotypes against them, that were really normalized in a way that maybe it was like about Black and Asian people in Britain in the early 1970s. And one review said, when we did the show, the journalist said, it seemed like 1,000 years of prejudice had evaporated in half an hour, right? That's the power of music. I really believe that. But I say that now, and look what's happened in Hungary. We've got Orban and, you know, the most dreadful persecution of every kind of minority in Hungary, and some invented, like, you know, anti-Semitic persecution when there are hardly any Jews in Hungary, you know, so it's actually got a lot worse. So that's quite sad. But at least for that moment, we involved a lot of young people that really didn't get a look into mainstream Hungarian society, let alone play quite a high profile gig, you know. So, and they were great as well. We basically combined the Asian Dub Foundation sound with the traditional Hungarian Roma music, which is really something else, you know. Yeah, so one of the other tracks, I mean, this track was released in like 2003, and its genesis was I met a filmmaker in France who'd made a short kind of science fiction piece looking at the future of borders 20 years from 2002, when I first wrote the lyrics. And he was talking about gun turrets, robot guards, a sort of real kind of Terminator kind of view of how borders are going to look in 20 years' time. And so we did this song called Fortress Europe. And the first opening lyric is 2022, a new European order. And all the kind of description and sort of talking about the 21st century exodus, that, you know, there should be no borders. If you don't like the effects, don't produce the cause. A lot of basically pro-immigrant, anti-xenophobic, pro-migrant, pro-refugee set of lyrics in a kind of sci-fi context. And over the past 20 years, the track has gone viral in various times. Like, for example, the war in Yugoslavia and the influx of refugees from Yugoslavia. That's when the track was released. And there was a whole load of stuff, you probably remember some of you, about people from Serbia and Albania coming in illegally to Britain. And that's what it actually addressed at the time. Then there was other times, like when David Cameron was talking about the swarm of Syrian refugees, the track went viral then. And of course, all around Brexit now, you know, and if you, the comments, they're quite harrowing and quite scary and horrible to read, but they're almost like a kind of short history of the various sort of narratives around immigration, both positive and extremely negative, if you read the comments. And we've got a lot of people sort of saying, 2022 is coming. This song has predicted the future, kind of crazy stuff like that. You see, when that first came out, it was actually attacking the EU's immigration policy with regard particularly to Yugoslavia. But now you can see it's completely turned around, the meaning. And when we've been playing it live before lockdown, it was like, oh yeah, Brexit and all the problems flowing from Brexit. So, you know, the Fortress Europe was actually Fortress Britain, if you see what I mean.
But let's hear a bit more, Jazz. I'd love for you to explain, it's really obvious this week why we need the worldwide tribe. But when did you realise that was needed? Like, what was the origin of that, and what's happening? I'd love for you to explain a bit more about what the Worldwide Tribe is and the work that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Although following that, Steve, all I want to do now is party. That was an absolute banger. Thank you for that. And it's such a pleasure to be here with everybody. I really appreciate you all being here tonight. As Matt and Steve have said before me, it couldn't be more apt timing to be talking about the issue of migration in the UK. I mean, hopefully you guys have all seen what's been going on with Priti Patel's overhaul of our asylum system in the last couple of days, and it's going to have pretty devastating consequences for people on the ground. But we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. But yeah, I will start by giving you a little bit of the Worldwide Tribe. I'll start from the beginning, shall I? So the Worldwide Tribe is a community of people who support refugees and who care about the world, the people that we share it with, I guess. And what we're really about is celebrating our differences, recognizing our similarities, recognizing what makes us all human, you know, finding connection and basic compassion and empathy. I think we could all do with a bit more of that, especially in our politics right now. And the essence of the Worldwide Tribe is that, you know, in an era of globalization, surely we can come together in one worldwide tribe, regardless of borders and nationalities and religions and other superficial things that might divide us, right? But I actually wanted to start today by telling you a bit of a story about one person in particular, someone who is very important to me, and his name is Mez. So Mez is from Eritrea. And when I met Mez, I had no idea about Eritrea, where it was, what was happening there. But turns out that they have compulsory military service in Eritrea. And Mez was very scared of being in the army. So when he was growing up, his older brother had already gone into the army, and his father was in and out of prison for fleeing the army. And both of them had horrible stories to tell about what it meant to be in the army in Eritrea. So in late 2014, Mez was about to turn 13 years old. He was 12, and he knew that his time was coming soon, right? It wouldn't be long before he would too be conscripted to the army. They start very young. And Mez always says, he puts it very beautifully. He says that what he wanted, what he needed, was to go to school to finish his education. He wanted to hold a pen and not a gun, right? So the day that the army came to Mez's village to conscript him and other 13-year-old boys of his age, him and two of his best friends ran. And they ran without a plan. They didn't know that they would not be going back. They didn't take anything with them. They didn't say goodbye to their mums. Mez didn't get an opportunity to tell his mum that he was safe until 6 weeks later, after he'd crossed the border into Ethiopia. So Eritrea borders Ethiopia and Sudan. It's in East Africa. I'm just saying that for if anyone like me doesn't know, I'm sure you guys do. But as I say, I was coming to this very naive when I first met Mez. And when Mez made it to Sudan, he lived in a refugee camp for a few months. And he realized that this too wasn't the place where he would be able to continue the life that he wanted, to go to school, to live in safety. He knew that he had to continue. So Mez continued his journey to Libya, in which he needed to cross the Sahara. It took him 15 days to do so. And one of Mez's friends didn't make it on that crossing. He fell off the truck that they were carrying on. Mez never saw him again. So this journey was difficult, very, very difficult at many points, the Sahara being one of the low points. It took him 15 days. As I said, they didn't have food. They had minimal water. Mez always says that it wasn't the hunger that he felt, it was the thirst. And eventually he made it to Libya, which many refugees have described to me since as being hell on earth. And he realized that there too, he couldn't stay. He couldn't stay in Libya. That also wasn't the country that would give him the opportunities that he so wanted and deserved for his life, right? So he knew he couldn't go back. He couldn't stay there, so he had to continue. And from Libya, the next stage of the journey is crossing the Mediterranean Sea. Now, you guys, I'm sure, have seen those crossings on boats, rubber dinghies, big overcrowded boats that are just absolutely not fit for purpose. And Mez was scared, right? He'd never seen the sea. He couldn't swim. But he knew that he had no other option but to take this risk. And Mez's nightmare came true when he crossed the Mediterranean. His boat capsized and everyone on board fell into the water. And Mez describes looking up at the sky and thinking, you know, this is it. I'm gonna die here in the Mediterranean. And thankfully a miracle happened and Mez was saved from the Mediterranean by the Italian Coast Guard. Now, again, as I say, this really was a miracle because this is the end of 2014, early 2015, when more rescue boats and coast guards were operating in the search and rescue zones in the Mediterranean. Unfortunately, less and less rescue boats are operating in this piece of sea, this area of the sea. And increasing amounts of people are dying in the Mediterranean. So Mez was one of the lucky ones. He was rescued. He was taken to Italy, where he was wrapped in an emergency blanket, given a plate of spaghetti, and essentially left to continue his journey alone. Mez hoped that once he made it to Europe, this would be the place that he could find safety, right? That this would be, okay, I'm in Europe now. here I will be safe. But he heard of many previous Eritreans being deported back to Eritrea from Italy. So he continued his journey. He walked across Europe until he made it to France. Sometimes he bunked on trains. He tells the story about one time when the ticket man came and he had no money, and a German lady put her arm around him and bought him a ticket and said to the ticket man that he was with her, which I always think is a really beautiful story. And I appreciate that lady. So Mez eventually found himself in the Calais jungle, the notorious Calais jungle. And again, you know, this was not a place for human beings to live, not a place for a 13-year-old boy to live. It's not safe. The people don't have their basic needs covered there. But there was no other option for Mez in France. Again, many people were being deported from France to Eritrea. It's very difficult to get your asylum claim heard or accepted due to pure numbers. So Mez, he listened to people before him and people around him who were trying to make it to the UK, where he was told that he would have the best chance of getting his asylum claim accepted. So one day in the summer, or one night in the summer of 2015, Mez hid underneath the Eurotunnel train and he made it to the UK. And that Sunday morning, social services in Kent, in Folkestone, they gave him some food and they gave him these big flip-flops that didn't fit him because his shoes were wet and his clothes were wet. And they put him in a taxi to my mum and dad's house. And my mum and dad had just come to the end of a long process of becoming foster parents. So Mez that day became my foster brother. The process had taken my mum and dad 9 months and it had taken Mez 9 months. And my mum always says that it was like a pregnancy. It's like the same as having a new baby. And that's literally what she felt like and acted like. And Mez became the first of four foster brothers in my family who were all unaccompanied minors, all refugees. And they all arrived to the UK taking similar routes like this. They're all from different countries, from Eritrea, Afghanistan, Sudan and Libya. And these are some of the highlights of these last 6 years for us. So you can see when Mez, he didn't speak English when he came to the UK. He learned English very quickly. He went to our local comprehensive school. He was voted prom king. I think there's a picture of him getting his travel documents here. And not only this, Mez now often works together with me to share his story. This is a picture of him at that local comprehensive school in Kent, in our local area, after he'd finished going back to tell his story, which he does a much better job with me, by the way. But he wanted to share with the students there so that if there were more unaccompanied minors coming to that school, that the students would have a little bit of an understanding of what had happened to him, right? Because when Mez first got there and people asked him, where are you from? When he said Eritrea, same reaction that I had, you know, people didn't know, they had no idea. And they didn't understand what Mez had had to go through to get to the same point that they were at, going to school every day, being able to continue his education, something that we take so much for granted, right? So Mez's journey came to a bit of an end, or at least one part of his journey came to an end when he made it to the UK. It was a whole nother journey, I guess, integrating, learning, seeing our culture through his eyes. But it really sparked the beginning of a journey for me, because at that time, as Steve mentioned, it was the summer of 2015 when the media was full of the refugee crisis, but not in a positive way. The representation of the people in Calais was super negative, stuff like swarms of migrants, marauding migrants, as Steve mentioned. And I really felt that there wasn't any kind of human story underneath that. You know, the questions that I had about who these people were, what happened to them, why they were there, the places that they come from. You know, at the time, I think we really associated the word refugee with the war in Syria. But actually, in Calais, you know, there were some Syrians, but there were predominantly Eritreans, Afghans, Sudanese people. And I met incredible people from all over the world. And when I've skipped forward, basically, but I essentially decided that I wanted to go to Calais and find out more and answer some of these questions myself. And as I say, I met people from everywhere, and it wasn't actually the conditions that shocked me most when I first went, although the fact that people were sleeping in tents in the mud was crazy. 3,000 people, men, women, children, the conditions were mental, and the fact that there were no large NGOs working on the ground as I expected. You know, I went there very naive. I didn't have a background in the humanitarian sector. I didn't know what to expect, but I expected if there were children living in a refugee camp in Europe, that there would be Save the Children, that there would be the UNHCR, that there would be the Red Cross, that, you know, those names that we know, that they would be there, that they would be present on the ground, and they weren't. There was no one present on the ground. There was one French lady from Calais who became a hero of mine, Maya, and she had been helping refugees in that area for years and years because she had grown up in Calais, and this has been a situation in Calais for a very long time. So I met Maya, but I didn't meet anyone else, any other volunteers that time when I first went, early days of the jungle, right? And when I was making my journey home from Calais, I really felt that there was an injustice at play, that there was something just so crazy. I can't even find the words to describe the feeling that I could make that journey home from France to the UK so easily in the comfort of my car. You know, I could drive onto the Eurotunnel train. Mez had to hide underneath. He had to tie his shoelaces to the bottom of the train so that his feet wouldn't drag on the track. Like, we're talking about people risking their lives on a daily basis to make this same journey that, you know, with this power of, have I got my passport in here? Maybe not. But with the power of this little book, I could so easily make. It didn't make sense to me. It doesn't make sense. It's completely nonsensical. And I was really feeling that basically on the journey home, especially because I felt like on that first trip I made connections with people that were just like you or me, that, you know, are just human beings, the same as we all are. Anyway, so I went home and I did what I did at that point, which is write about it on Facebook. I'm not using Facebook so much these days, but at the time I was. And I wanted my friends and family, I guess, to know about the situation, to know that I wanted to go again, to know that people needed basic stuff like tents, sleeping bags, warm clothing. They were cold at night. They were hungry during the day. Anyway, that post, let me see, what's this little video? Oh yeah, that post. Next morning, I got up to go to work and it had been shared thousands and thousands of times. And I did something very, very stupid on that post by sharing my address and my mum and dad's address for the people in Kent and for the people in London, just saying like, if you've got any stuff, drop it over. We'll bring it to Calais. Little did I know what that would lead to. And as you can see, this is one of our donation drop days. And we were overwhelmed basically by the incredible outpouring of support from people, not just all over the UK, all over Europe in the end. We had drop-off days, donation days, people sending Amazon deliveries to us with brand new tents, putting together care packages, writing notes, knitting warm clothing. It was like absolutely unreal, the response that we had to, I guess, I guess people were ready to hear a bit of a different story. And that was the beginning of the Worldwide Tribe. That was the beginning of this online community where we shared information to do our best to support refugees and asylum seekers. Initially in Calais, we extended our work to Greece, to Turkey, to Jordan, to Lebanon. And we started with basic needs, tents, sleeping bags, shoes. Lots of people like Mez in Calais didn't have proper footwear. It was cold, it was muddy. Anyway, I soon realized that actually, although tents and sleeping bags were hugely valuable and important and life-saving, you know, these camps shouldn't be there in the first place. As much of this stuff that you can distribute. They shouldn't exist. People shouldn't be living like this at all. So we decided to try and raise awareness, to educate, I guess, in, because I feel like if you can get to the bottom of the issue, if you can really dig down to this, to the very lower levels, like what's going on here, I think it's a lack of understanding and information about the situation, right? Because anybody who actually knew what Mez had been through, what this kid Nahom had been through, what the people in these camps had been through to get there, they were heroes. They were all heroes. And so we started to make films. We started to give more talks and things, and we started to create infographics that like unpicked some of the myths. And most recently we started a podcast. The Worldwide Tribe podcast has been running for nearly 2 years now, but it highlights and amplifies the stories of these incredible people and humans behind these headlines, I guess, and just incredible stories that I've heard over these years. One of my guests, Awad, is on the call today. You're going to be hearing from him very shortly, hopefully. He was my second ever guest on the podcast and a very good friend of mine. I've heard from, this is Gawali Pasali, who wrote an incredible book called The Lightless Sky. If anyone wants something, I think there's a, oh yeah, it's on the desk in this picture. So it's his story of arriving to the UK as a child refugee from Afghanistan. Here's Mez doing an episode with me. He's my only guest that's been on two episodes because the story is so epic. The journey from Eritrea to the UK, and then the second episode was his life since he's been in the UK, which is a whole journey of itself. But, you know, over the years, I guess, asking questions and digging deeper below the surface and trying to kind of unpick some of the fear that we have around the other. I've been to all sorts of places and met incredible people, as I say, but this year, all of our travel has been more restricted, right? Because of the pandemic, because of COVID. And actually it's helped us to focus closer to home. And there's so much happening close to home that we need to pay attention to. For example, we saw in the last year, in the last summer, an increase in crossings on the channel in boats, right? That was in our news all over again. And so in response to that, we made a little film. We're still making films often. Let me see if I can, here you go. And this film features Mez and my Sudanese brother, Bijo. We shot it in Hastings. And I'd love to finish today with sharing it with you, because for me, this film really highlights the essence of the Worldwide Tribe, the reason why we do what we do, I guess, the reason why we exist. And it's also very personal to me. It's the first time we've shared Mez's story in this way through film. It shares a little bit from my mum. Yeah, I'll stop talking about it and I'll show it to you. And I hope that you guys enjoy it. How's that now? Can you hear some music?
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, great. Has resulted in tragedy after two adults and two children died when the boat carrying them sank. French officials say that 15 others have been taken to hospital.
Today that a teenager, a 16-year-old, has been found dead on the beach of Calais. We believe that it's a migrant from Sudanese descent.
I just remember how cold the water was when the boat capsized. That's all I could feel.
I had never seen the sea before. The darkness of the water surprised me.
I was very, very scared. Our smuggler told us not to move around at all. None of us could swim. If I go in, I'll die. The only thing that we can do is hold each other in tight and pray so we don't drown.
This is the house that arrived 5 years ago. The taxi driver was trying to find the house and everything, and then he pulled up over here and I was literally standing here same, and then I didn't know what to expect. I don't know if it's Eritrean family or English family. When they opened the door, it was a lot of happy people, welcoming, very nice, the happiest day of my life.
On the day that he came, we'd all been waiting, and there he was. His eyes were full of trauma. I just wanted to put my arms around him and tell him it would all be okay, that he was safe now. I've now gone through the process 3 more times with the other boys, and each time it has brought me so much joy.
My mum, this family means literally everything to me. It feels like a dream.
I didn't know these boys 5 years ago, but now they're my sons.
As soon as I got to this house, I feel connected to them, just like that. We all love each other, respect each other. This is what I love about this family.
I feel happy, safe, and I feel loved.
I love having all my family at home around a big dinner table. And there's always space for one more person. I'm not just caring for them. I love them.
That's the story, really. I've got loads more that I could talk about. And I really wanted to share Mez's story today because I think that, it's really important right now to recognise the implications of this overhaul of the asylum system on people. And under Priti Patel's new plans, Mez would be deported immediately to Eritrea. And many, many people and friends that I've made would too. And future people like Mez, Mez has got a little brother who's also just left Eritrea to go to Ethiopia because he doesn't want to be in the army. And he has no opportunity to seek asylum in England now. I think it's really important for us to be talking about this, for us to understand the impact on human lives of what our government is proposing right now. So thank you for listening to me, and thank you for watching that video with me and bearing with me, because it's an important one on a personal level, I guess.
Hey, hello.
Oh, yay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. And I'm so grateful that you're here with us today, Awad, because just to give you guys a little bit of background, Awad and I met in Calais when he was living in the jungle, and he taught me so much about patience, about kindness, about sharing. I mean, he just became a kind of informal leader of the Sudanese community, built entirely on respect. He was living in the camp himself, but working with volunteers to help with distribution. So it's just an honor that you're actually here with us today, Awad, and I'm happy to see your face.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to share a part of my story and to be a part of the great work you are doing. My name is Awad. I'm a refugee from Sudan based in Edinburgh. I left Sudan 2011. I came through a long journey, made it to Turkey to Greece. I lived in Greece for a couple of years. I went to jail, and that was the first time in the whole entire of my life to be in a jail. It's just for no reason. And I tried many times to just leave Greece, cross to Albania, Albania, Montenegro, and then I got caught there, sent back to Greece again, then made it to France. And I've been in Calais jungle for 3 years trying to make it to the UK, and finally happened. And it was really, really hard journey. But I've learned a lot of lessons that shaped my life. And I trust the process, accepting the hardship, it will happen along my journey and along the way to success, and also having faith and believe that things will work out on its own way. So that gives me like a hope to continue and to do like same what I used to do in Calais, trying helping people or trying to be supportive. And this is one of the things also motivate me to do more and more and helping raise awareness and to bring back the unheard voice again and to discuss one of the very important issues now, the refugees crisis. And I really appreciate the great work that you are doing, guys, and thank you very much. And thank you for giving me that time. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Awad.
First of all, Jazz, I wonder if there's anything you want to talk about what's happening at, you know, currently right now, like what are the things this week, especially, but more generally, like how can people help? How can people get involved? What can people do as individuals?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say first things first is that actually it is really valuable. I know signing something doesn't always feel like a big action or writing to your MP, but I've recognized in the last 5 years how important that actually is and can be. You know, we live in a country where we do have democracy and it is important to be kind of exercising those rights as much as we can. So on Choose Love's Instagram, there's a petition to stop this overhaul, this proposal from Priti Patel of the new asylum plans. So I would recommend everyone to go and sign that. It will take literally minutes. so that's a good place to start. But in terms of what you can do and how you can get involved, there are so many ways. So through the Worldwide Tribe, there are the obvious ways of volunteering with our friends, Indigo Volunteers. They place people in volunteer placements, grassroots volunteer placements. They're wonderful. I would really recommend checking them out, but also donating. I think there's a donation link in our chat, but maybe it's not money or time that you have to give, you know, but I always say that you don't actually need either of those things. There are things that you can do literally today, which is examples of like reading Gowali's book, The Lightless Sky. That's a great place to start. Watching a film tonight. I don't know if any of you guys have seen For Sama. That's on 4OD. It's free. It's amazing. Again, I'm thinking about people that were on my podcast. So the director, Wad, she filmed For Sama whilst she was living under siege in Aleppo for 5 years. And she was a guest on the podcast and has a really incredible story. Sama is her daughter, and she documented her journey for her daughter to highlight why they stayed in Aleppo. You're listening to the podcast, listen to Awad's episode, mine and Awad's episode. You'll get an opportunity to get some amazing insights from him there. But yeah, there's lots of what I think, you know, education and learning in your own like space, in your own world is really important. So I think those are really easy ways to curating your Instagram feed, you know, follow Asian Dove Foundation, follow Choose Love, follow there's so many incredible people doing like grassroots people doing incredible work. So I would also recommend that so that you can be ready when the opportunities come up. Ra, I think I can see Ishana here from Ra Fest. That's another great, great organisation to be following. That's RAAH. Yeah, I could go on and on, Matt. You've got to stop me. Just one more thing that I remember now as you say that is having these conversations is so important. Having these difficult conversations with people that, you know, we've all got that friend or family member or who might have a different viewpoint from us, and having these, sharing information, sharing the post. You know, we just put out the 7 main points of Priti Patel's proposal on our Instagram, which breaks it down to be very accessible to understand. So reading that and sharing it, and maybe one more person will see it and think, oh, okay, that I don't want that. Maybe they'll add to the, you know, it's a ripple. And I think that social media really enables us to connect with people and like really harness the power of people coming together.
Yeah, I just wanted to make 2 points, actually, one very general and one very specific. Actually, one thing Jazz said, which I think is really, really important, is bringing the stories to the public, putting a face to things, putting a story, just like Jazz did, you know. And because if you cast your mind back like 5 or 6 years to when David Cameron made that appalling speech, you know, very cynically put together, using the word swarm, a swarm of Syrian migrants coming in. I think I'm right in saying within about 2 or 3 weeks, and it took the Turkish, poor Turkish boy to drown in the sea. Yeah. Then all of a sudden, the whole tone of the national conversation changes. Right. And all of a sudden, Daily Mail, Daily Express, who've been, you know, pure xenophobia, a complete dehumanization of talking about, you know, an inferior people coming in en masse. Right. It took a little boy to die and a face being put to it before they start saying, oh, we feel so sorry. Oh, no, you know. And then David Cameron himself started saying about, oh, the tragedy and what have you. Right. Now, that's an extreme version. But basically, the last thing that the xenophobes and the right wing want is for you to put a face to the people, right? And that's why Jazz's film was so important, I think. And I think seeing what people are doing, you know, seeing how people are integrating in schools, the work people are doing, right, the contribution that people who settle here make is so important. And you just keep hammering it. I mean, we kind of did it with Stuart Lee on coming over here. I mean, that's a wild sort of, outlying example, but it was putting in the consciousness about the positive contribution of immigration and also who are immigrants. The Anglo-Saxons were as well, invaders even, you know, that's an outlier. But a more specific thing is the one thing that was really nice that happened because of the track. I got contacted by an organization called the Community Integration Awards. And Joe Cox's sister spoke at it. You know, so you had Joe Cox's sister, Asian Dub Foundation with the track. And we were handing out, or we were sort of joining in with the actual awards that were being handed out to what were largely refugee and asylum seeker driven projects, right? So it's worth looking at that. Community Integration Awards, a fantastic array of projects, mainly run by asylum seekers, refugees, everything ranging from music projects, which were very similar to the kind of things that I did with Community Music and ADF, to things as diverse as beekeeping projects, which were absolutely fascinating, which was run by a Syrian refugee. I'm not sure where it was, but you can find out. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing, you know. Put the faces out there. Show what the people that Priti Patel's vicious kind of like and deliberately kind of sadistic. You know, I do think there is a genuine sense of sadism about this this particular brand of conservatism, you know, coming from a daughter of immigrants herself, you know, who would not have been, I mean, despite her protestations, her parents would not have been allowed in under any of the regime that we have now, you know. So it's sort of doubly sickening. We need to expose it and we need to show the people, you know, show the stories, the pain, the reality of it, and not let the Daily Mail or whatever just turn it into people, for want of a better term, SHIT, to be shoveled, because that is really the how it's framed, you know.
Steve, the other thing you touched on earlier but didn't get into really was education and that side of music. And I'm thinking about community music here. Yeah. And you know, could you just tell us a little bit briefly about, you know, what that is, how it founded, and your continuing involvement with it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it has changed a lot. It's not how it was when we started in the 90s, you know, but I can give you a flavour of it. I mean, one of the first things that I did was a project in a place called Asian Action Group in Turnpike Lane. And this was a tough place. I mean, there was a green outside the Asian Action Group youth club, the place. Basically, it was like, you know, cocaine and crack were being dealt, and a lot of problems with drug gangs, with gangs generally. And I remember I walked in there with a sampler and a drum machine and a microphone. And we got a kind of jungle groove going. And all the kids brought their samples in. We put it all together. And then we said, what's this track going to be about? And then on the wall, there was this cartoon which said, there was a caricature of a judge who just said in court, oh, all these Bengalis look the same to me. And that was on the wall. And so I had this sort of like group of about 10 young Asian kids of about 12 or 13, all jumping up and down, the fist in the air going like, judge say, all Asians look the same, with this heavy bass and jungle breakbeat. It was really something, you know. And that is actually how the Asian Dub Foundation sound evolved, right? It's not just that we were this group, like, you know, getting people involved and whatever. What we did believe, and this is what was a bit different to a lot of sort of like music workshops and what have you, we actually believe fundamentally that giving people access to music whose voices hadn't been heard, right, who were usually suppressed or taken out of the picture, that actually you get new music. New, vital, exciting, and radical music, right? And Asian Dub Foundation was the living proof of that. There's no way the band would have sounded like it did had it not had this root in music education. And this took a lot of people by surprise, you know, the people like the NME and what have you, who had to take notice of us because we had all these kind of people giving us their blessing, like Radiohead, Primal Scream and that. And really, we were going doing the complete opposite of rock and roll, which is all about this kind of, you know, massive cult of personality, superstars and slaves and stuff. It was completely opposite. It was egalitarian. And it was basically genuinely saying, you can do this. Here are the tools, right? And not just like, but people who really never got the chance before, right? Mm. So that, yeah. That was the kind of like, the kind of thread that took us through. Now it's a bit different now.
I remember that though, Steve, at the time, the Manchester Academy Bratz tour.
Yeah.
The first time I saw ADF, like 91, 92, and just it being literally otherworldly, you know, compared to everything else that was around in terms of music journalism and everything that was going on. So, you know, it was definitely a shot in the arm.
Well, you see, given the background of the group and also the sort of the overt political, for want of a better name, that wasn't supposed to be good in that period in the 90s. It was all about, as I said, superstars and slaves and more traditional kind of like superstar mentality. You know, so we were just so in the face of everything, and musically too as well, you know, because we were a live band with guitars and bass, but we were actually playing a kind of club sound system based music. But we were actually, at the time anyway, showing up your more traditional guitar groups, but basically being better than, you know, and better, not because of our egos or whatever, or because we are these brilliant musicians, but because we come out of this philosophy, which was bigger than us and a lot older than us as well. You know, we didn't make that. Community music and the philosophy that it was based on created and facilitated and nurtured it, you know?
Yeah.
And it had been doing so since the early 70s.
Thank you for listening to Stories That Matter, the Hawkwood podcast. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, tell your friends, sign up to our mailing list, or on social media.